Does anybody have this book? Okay. Okay, and it has an appendix D. And every differential geometry book, or that's not true, I'm sure, many differential geometry books and many general relativity books have equivalent material.
Can I ask what we will cover tonight?
Yeah, so you may know this. In fact, I think you've taught this,
yeah.
So you don't have to stay. I'm going to talk about differential forms, and then I'm going to do Maxwell theory, Lagrangian and Hamiltonian, and then if I get to it, I'm going to do Yang-Mills theory. Okay. So let me start by fixing, and I'm not exactly sure where to start. So have you had basic manifold theory, differential geometry? Okay. So we have a manifold. On a manifold, we have functions to the real numbers. Let me just review about, so are you guys happy with tensors and forms, or shall I? Okay. So at a point of the manifold, we have the tangent space. Just to make sure everybody is here. A tangent space is defined by a vector field. And a vector field is defined acting on functions. And it can be expanded like dA, dAf, where dAf is the derivatives in some coordinates. So I have some coordinates. X1, X2, etc. For XA on the manifold here. Sorry, my chalk is running out. And then, so these are vector fields. And then there are one-forms. One-forms are maps from vector fields to functions. So a vector field, omega, is an object where you act on vector fields and you get a function. And the function that you get is written as omega A in any coordinate system, VA. So generally, a one form has the form. So dual to, let me say it this way. Dual to functions to derivatives are differentials. So dx. And if I take d of all the coordinates, let me see if that's right. Yes, they serve as a basis. So I'm saying this badly. Such a one form can be written, and I'm assuming you know this, and tell me if you don't, as a set of objects with a lower index contracted with dxa. And the basic idea of the contraction is that the dxa are a basis for the dual space of the vector field. So dxa are a basis of the dual space, the tangent space, the space dual to the tangent space. And the contraction between the space and the dual space is defined by this way. Okay. And please, I mean, this is, anybody interrupt me if I say something you don't know. Okay. So these are one forms. And then we can go on and define tensors of various ranks and so forth by multilinear maps. So we can define an object, say, I don't know, rho is a function of three vector fields, U, V, V, W, I don't know, X, but those are all vector fields. So the numbers, and that would be written as rho A, B, C, V, A, W, V, X, C. So we get tensors from multilinear maps of various kinds. Now, the interesting thing about differential forms is that objects which are purely forms rather than vectorial and anti-symmetric have nice properties under derivatives. And the idea is that if I have a, so let me just give the basic point. If I have a function, then I can talk about the derivatives of a function, and that is well defined. In particular, given a function, I can write a one-form whose components are the derivatives of the function, and this is also sometimes written as df, and this is well defined. And the reason why this is well defined is that derivatives of functions are well defined. We know what it means when we have a manifold to talk about derivatives of functions on the manifold. Okay. On the other hand, derivatives of vector fields are generally not well defined. Generally, if I have a vector field, VA, and I try to talk about the derivatives of the vector field, this is not well defined. And you can see this is not well defined if you make a coordinate transformation. So this is not well defined. And one way to see it is that under, so let me make a coordinate transformation, xA goes to x prime A, then del A goes to del xA prime, del xA, del A prime. Let me just fill that in. Del by del xA goes to del by del xA prime. Similarly, dxA goes to dxA prime times del xA prime, which is the inverse transformation. And therefore, components transform that way. The components dA go to dA prime, which transform like this, del xA, del xA prime, actually the opposite, sorry, dA. And if I try to take another derivative of that, del B dA, then I end up saying, does that go to del B prime dA prime? But the problem is that there's no problem with the derivatives. I have del xB prime, del xB, but now I have d by d xB prime of the whole thing. dA, and I'm going to pick up derivatives of the coordinate transformations. So derivatives of vector fields do not transform nicely under coordinate transformations, and neither do derivatives of one-forms. But a very nice thing happens if you take derivatives of forms and you symmetrize. Now, by the way, why am I interested in this? If I had a metric, I could define a covariant derivative with respect to a metric. And that's what they will do in the general relativity book. So you can define, it's true that you can define a covariant derivative. So del A, say, of omega B, which is the ordinary derivative, I now forget this, minus or plus del A, B, C, omega C, where that's the Gustavo coefficients. And then that does transform nicely by virtue of the Gustavo coefficients transforming like a mess to soak up the derivatives that come into here, the derivatives of the Fourier transformations. So that's one thing you can do, but that is imposing structure, which is the definition of a covariant derivative. And a covariant derivative generally depends on a metric, depends on a metric through the derivative of the metric covariantly being zero. And so now you have structure which is based on a metric. But we want to do quantum gravity where the metric is an operator. So we're very limited in when derivatives are well defined. And the only cases when derivatives are well defined turn out to have to do with derivatives of forms which are anti-symmetrized. So just to give you the example, derivative, and then I'll write it out once, and then I'm never going to write stuff like this. This goes to del A prime omega B prime, which is del A prime del X B del X B prime omega B, and it transforms nicely except for this piece here. But if you anti-symmetrize, then the bad piece looks like the second derivative, del xb, del x a prime, del x b prime, omega b. And if we took the anti-symmetric part, then we would take the anti-symmetric, so it's this plus something which is okay. And the anti-symmetric part vanishes because second derivatives commute. So if we take the anti-symmetric part, these bad guys go away. And so the anti-symmetric components of derivatives of one form are well defined even in the absence of a metric or a notion of a covariant derivative. So we actually talk about two forms, and two forms are defined to be objects which are, if one forms are objects like these proportional to the dx's, then two forms are objects like this phi ab dx a tensor dx b, where we're anti-symmetrizing in those two indices there. And does everybody know what that means when I say anti-symmetrizing? Okay. If I have a tensor anti-symmetrizing, I mean 1/2 AAB minus ABA. And those 1/2s are very annoying, but they're there in most treatments. So we're going to keep them. Okay, it's a question of conventions where you put factors. There's lots of little combinatorial factors, and I'm trying to be conventional. So, because that comes up, the anti-symmetrization of forms comes up, and I just want to look and make sure which definition he's using, comes up so often. We define the wedge product. So if you have, so these guys of this form are two forms, And one way to get two forms is to take two one forms. So if omega and rho are one forms, and you take their tensor product minus the tensor product in the opposite order with the 1/2, then that is generally defined to be omega wedge rho. So if I take the tensor product of one form and I anti-symmetrize, I get a two form. Equivalently, and I can do that for, I can go higher up in degree. So, let me write one thing about this. If these are expressed as omega A dx A is omega and if rho is rho A dx A, then omega wedge rho is 1/2 omega A rho B times dx A wedge dx B. So we often wedge the basis elements like that. Okay? And a last piece of notation is that another way to get a way to get a two form from a one form is to define automatically to take the derivatives and take the anti-symmetric part. So d of omega is defined to be a two form, which is del, whose components are del A omega B, dx A wedge dx B. And that defines what's called the D operator. Then there's a nice, beautiful structure, which is that you can extend that up to the dimension of the manifold. So I can have a P form, and a P form is an object of the form omega is equal to omega A1 to AP times dx A1 wedge, you wedge all of them up to dx AP. And there is a 1 over p factorial. No, actually, it's in the wedge product. I don't mean that. It's written like that. Okay, questions? Am I telling you things you know? Yes. Should I go faster? Is that okay? You don't mind hearing things you know?
Yeah. We do, man.
Okay. Well, I'll very quickly do electromagnetism in this form, which you may not know, or you may
know.
You
could know it again.
Okay. Good. Okay. So for any p form, then d of omega is a p plus one form whose components are del. Let me call it b. Omega A1 to AP of dx B wedge dx A1 dx AP. And what's nice about this is that all these derivatives are meaningful in the absence of a metric. And then there's a nice little prize that you get, which is that d squared is equal to 0. Because let me compute d squared of some p form, so that's d of d, so that is del c times del b times omega a1 to ap dx c wedge dx b wedge dx a1 wedge dx an. But this is anti-symmetric in c and d, so it takes the anti-symmetric part of the derivatives, but derivatives can either, so that's zero. Okay. And there are fancy words for this, but I think that's good enough. Okay, any questions? Now, let's just talk about what electromagnetism looks like in this language. So, the idea is that there is a vector potential. So the vector potential, and this is in four-dimensional space-time. So this is in both space and time. And it's a one-form. Sometimes, so there are different notations in use, and there are at least three different notations which are in use about things like this. So, and actually this is worth a little side story. So, as I've been writing everything, then I have been writing things as if, say, A is a one form. That means abstractly, it's a map from vector fields to functions. So this is the object is a one form. It's a map from vector fields to functions, which is equal to A of V. Then we talk about its components in a basis, and in a coordinate basis, so that A is of the form of A, dx, A, where this is the differentials of some system of coordinates. And in that case, V also is VA, d by dx, A. And this is A, the action in any set of coordinates. So that's a common notation, is the actual objects have no letters on them. And the components in a basis have letters on them, expressing the expansion in the basis. So the A, lower A's are functions, which are the components of this abstract object in the basis. And this is called coordinate notation. And in older books on general relativity and mathematics, everything is expressed in coordinates. And they spend a lot of time worrying about expressions of this form, about how things transform under changing coordinates and so forth. Because everything is expressed in terms of coordinates. Then the mathematicians, sometime in the 1960s, began saying, look, we know how things transform under coordinates. That's trivial. That's part of the definition of what a vector field is, or a one form is, or a two form is. So let's just deal with the actual mathematical object. And so then they would just write that, or that, for the action, because all of these things have a meaning independent of coordinates. A one form is well defined independent of any coordinates. So why refer to its components in some coordinate system? And they realized that there are a lot of calculations you never need to do, because there's usually a good mathematical argument to a mathematical relation between objects without having to go through relations between the functions that are their components in a coordinate system. Yeah?
It's like comparing Einstein's dynamics with modern dynamics books.
Exactly. Yeah. No. Exactly. So the mathematicians began using this notation in which, you know, a one form is just an object A, a vector field is an object V, and you can't tell who is who except from reading the text, where it's defined this is a one form, this is a two form, etc. Okay. Then Wong, bless his heart, invented another notation, and in Wong's notation, AA is a one form, and V is a vector field, and the indices are not labeling functions which are components in a basis. This just tells you, the little index is just a little symbol that just tells you that that's a one form, and the little symbol there just tells you it's a vector field. And the contraction A of V, he would just write as AA, VA, but it just means the abstract combination, just the abstract map that the one form is acting on a vector field, which is also a map. There's no reference to coordinates. So this is called abstract index notation. And the basic idea is that you can have the calculational simplicity of the guys with all the indices, but you're actually doing mathematics rather than playing with indices and functions and so forth. The only thing is that this leads to distortions, like expanded in the basis, this is V mu, so you have to use some other letter for it, times D by D X mu A, where the A is sitting, the B, where the B is sitting there just because the derivative operators are one forms, excuse me, are vector fields. So because they're vector fields, they have to have an index. And the mu now, so you have two indices, one set of indices tells you what things are and how to operate with them, and the other set of indices tells you actually when you have functions, what are the components in coordinate systems and so forth. Okay. So these days most working physicists and mathematicians, most working physicists use some combination of all three of those, and they never tell you which. And they never know which they're going to happen to write down. At least that's true of me. And mathematicians still tend to use this purely abstract notation, which can get really groggy and ugly. And then there's a really good notation. The really good notation is Penrose's notation, which we'll get to eventually, which turns all these things into pictures, which is actually the most useful notation for calculation. Okay. So, anybody have any preference of which notation I use?
No.
I'm not going to use it now. So I'm going to use the wall, so that's a one form, okay? And if you want to see it as the components in a basis, you're welcome to, but I'm going to use wall's notation. Because it actually is very convenient. Wall was not done. So that's a one form, the vector potential, and the idea is that the electromagnetic fields, FAB, are the two form you get by DA. And since that's a two form, you have to write it like that. Okay. And if you remember, just to say, if I write it down explicitly in a basis, then this is 0, E1, E2, E3 minus E1 to the anti-symmetric minus E2 minus E3 0, 0 to the anti-symmetric, so the diagonal parts are 0. And this is B3 minus B2 B1. So the idea is that the magnetic field, the electric fields EA are basically the zero components of F are, quote, the electric fields, and the magnetic fields, BA, are epsilon ABC, FBC over 2, they're the spatial parts. And now I'm using, I've completely screwed up. Help. Sorry, I won't do that to you. So I'll use ABC for four-dimensional notation and IJK for three-dimensional notation.
Okay. So can you use Penrose's?
Well, this is hard to do in Penrose. So an index A stands for I and 0, and I stands for 1, 2, and 3, the spatial components. Okay? So this is a 4x4 anti-symmetric matrix when you write out in components, which are the electric and the magnetic fields. Okay. But it's just defined as D of a one form. Okay, now, when you say that the physical fields are the electric and magnetic fields, then there's an ambiguity, which is what we call gauge invariance. So gauge invariance is that if I make a transformation where I take the one form and I change it to a new one form, which is the old one, plus adding the derivative of a function, then you can also write this without the indices, just so you see it in all the notations. It's A plus DF written that way. And then what happens to F? Well, F goes to F prime, which is D of A prime, which is D of A plus D squared on F. See how nice the notation is. So this is zero. This is another way of saying that the curl of the gradient is zero. But it just falls out as a notation. And therefore, the f's, f prime is equal to f. And therefore, the electric and magnetic fields are gauge invariant. Now that's an example of the gauge invariance. It's somewhat different from the time reparametrization one we discussed, but not that different. Very related. Yeah.
Since this A index has got no heterogeneous coordinates, what exactly do you mean by del A?
I mean, if I had a coordinate, it would be.
Maybe it's not some sort of abstract basis, whereby you sort of need to transform it to a symmetric basis from the coordinate basis and then take a derivative as a limited combination of coordinate derivatives or anything like that.
What you said is true. In a given coordinate system, it would be a linear combination of coordinate derivatives. And you can show that. I'm doing things deliberately, sometimes with the indices and sometimes without, because that's what you see in real life. Okay. People are very inconsistent. Sometimes they use them, sometimes they don't use them. Okay. You can see it wouldn't have helped this little argument to write all the indices. Because the key thing is once you prove that d squared is equal to zero, you use it wherever you can. Okay. Well, there are some other consequences. So another consequence is that d of f is equal to zero. And that's part of Maxwell's equations. I forget what those are called.
Source free.
No, but that's a piece. There's a name for them, which I don't remember what it is, because I just remember it as that. It's the, what it is, it's the equation that says E dot plus del cross B is equal to zero. To write it out. Is that right? No, I'm sorry. That's not true. It's just the equation that says del. Well, it has a space part. It's the equation that says this del cross B is equal to zero. Sorry. Okay. Now, Maxwell's equations come from an action. So I want to go through the equations of motion from a variational principle, because that really is the best way to see dynamics always. So now I'm going to impose a metric.
So it should be no magnetic monopoles, right?
Yes.
Divergence would be equal to zero, of course.
All right. What, my sound?
I mean, I think the other equation you wrote down is correct also.
It is correct, but it doesn't follow from this.
Or it's just the B to T plus delta z equals zero. It's one of those two.
Yes.
But I don't know which one.
We could write it out, but I'm not going to do it right now. So that's homework.
D equals zero will have four components, right? So it'll be two of them. Or I guess if you write them in 3D, it'll be two.
It's four equations. These are one of them, because
yes.
This is one equation. And then there's three.
Yeah, okay. Which are
that? Yeah. So if I impose a metric, I can write an action, which is the integral d4x, and I'm going to do this in four space-time dimensions. And the metric I'm going to impose is a to ab Minkowski metric, minus 1 plus. And I'm going to take minus 1/4, and I'm going to take cf ab, fcd, and I'm going to contract the indices a to ac, a to bb. And that's called the Maxwell action, because that gives you Maxwell's equations.
These are really coordinated groups in the
It could be. Doesn't matter. It could be coordinate or not. That's the beauty of the notation. Doesn't need to be. Okay. I'm just exactly not tall enough to gracefully get the board down. They designed it that way. Okay. Now, probably something you haven't done is done field theory with gradients of motion and Hamiltonians and fields. Is that right? I would guess you haven't done that.
Yes, you're right.
Yes. Okay. So.
Here's the answer, Joel.
Yeah. So let's take a little moment to talk about field theory in a Hamiltonian and Lagrangian point of view. And let's start off with a free scalar field, and then we'll get up to Maxwell. So a free scalar field is an object phi, which is a function of the xA, which is a function of x to xi and t, which is just a scalar. So it has no transformation properties. And the simplest equation that it can obey, which is a dynamic equation, is the del inversion of it is zero, where del is equal to a to ab, del a, del b, and in a coordinate system, that's minus del squared, del t squared, plus del squared, del xi squared. Which is also another way to say that is del squared, del t squared, minus plus Poisson squared. And I'm in a set of units where the speed of light is equal to 1. Otherwise, I'd have a speed of light down here. Okay? Now, I would like to write a Lagrangian for that. And the simplest Lagrangian I can write that gives that is the integral d4x a to ab, del ax, del b, del a phi, del b phi, with a 1/2. Okay? And I'm in Minkowski, flat Minkowski space. Okay. Now, the idea is that of Lagrangian, or an action principle, is that you take the variational derivative of the action and you set it equal to zero. So I want to study taking the variational derivative of that on S and setting that equal to zero to find the equations of motion. Okay. And you've done that, I assume, if not, I'll review it. You've done that for just ordinary particles moving. Yes, okay. So it starts the same way. We start computing del S is 1/2 integral d4x. The a to ab stays here. And now we can take the variation of the derivative of phi times the derivative of phi. And then there's the other term. But because this is symmetric in a and b, then you just get a factor of 2 there. Okay. Now, just you've used this relation before in variations. The variation of the derivative of a function, let me just let that be phi, is the same thing as the derivative of the variation. So the delta means we're making a small change in the history of the system, in the configuration of the system, and the derivative of the small change is the same thing as the small change in the derivative. So therefore, this is integral d4x, a to ab, and now I can put the derivative there. I have delta phi, and I have d phi, del d phi, like that. Okay. Now I integrate by parts. And I integrate by parts, and I will assume that there is no boundary term. To evaluate. One way to have there be no boundary term is that if there is, if we're doing this in some region in space and time, we can impose that phi at the boundary is zero. And also that delta phi on the boundary is zero. Okay, so we're making a change of the system, but keeping phi zero and fixed on the boundary. And then there's no, and that's, these are integral in space and time, so that's in the boundary in space and time. Then I can integrate by parts. The Minkowski metric is a constant, so the derivative doesn't see it. And this is the integral of d4x minus from the integration by parts, delta phi times the expression a to ab, del a, del b, phi. If we want this to be zero for every small change, which is what the variational principle says, it says you get the equations of motion when the action is, when the variation of the action is zero for every small change, this has to be zero for every delta phi. We just have the condition that the delta phi vanishes at the boundary. And so this being zero for every delta phi implies that this, which is box phi, is equal to zero. Okay? Any questions? It's like what you're used to doing, but there's an additional label here, which is the coordinate in space and time. Okay. Now, since we're going to have to be using, Hamiltonian methods, let's look at that through the lens of a Hamiltonian system. So to write the Hamiltonian, I actually now care about who time is. So I'm going to be a little bit more precise. The action is 1/2 d3 space dt of time. And I have minus del 0, which is the time coordinate of phi squared, plus the spatial derivative. I mean, I'm using confusing, I'll use the same notation, of phi squared. Okay, that's just the same thing. The momentum, pi, at a point x of space and t of time, is the variation of the action by the time derivative of the coordinate. So this is like the phi at every point of space is a separate dynamical system. It's like a separate particle. And where often you would have a sum over different particles, now you have an integral over space and a label here like that. Okay, but otherwise it's like a system of many, you can think of it as a system of many particles. So this is, and I see I have the sign wrong, so there should overall have been a sign minus there, so please put that upstairs somewhere. Then the derivative of s with respect to phi dot is twice because of the square times 1/2 times just phi dot again. So the canonical momentum is phi dot. The Hamiltonian is the sum over the system, which is the sum over space, because that's like the labels of the different particles. It's like the integral over space of pi phi dot minus the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is all of this here. And so the Hamiltonian is the integral of space, and I get pi squared minus, the Lagrangian has a term which is minus minus phi dot squared, but phi dot squared is pi squared, but there's a 1/2, so I get pi squared minus 1/2 pi squared, so that's 1/2 pi squared, and then minus a minus, which turns into a plus, spatial derivative of phi squared. So that's the Hamiltonian. The Poisson bracket is phi at a point x with pi at a point y, Poisson bracket, and now you can't have 1 and 0 because these are continuum quantities. So you have the delta function, delta 3 of x and y. And this is the delta functional that I discussed last time, where it's actually the density over the y, if you want to integrate it. Okay?
What if this really mean with the density, or I mean, isn't it symmetric between nothing?
It's not symmetric.
I didn't really understand.
Yeah, it's not symmetric. It's not symmetric. And the meaning is that this actually transforms like a density. And I would prefer to postpone that at the moment because I want to do a whole talk about densities, but not right now. Because densities are a whole issue and there's a way to get to them through differential forms. I thought I'm going to postpone that. But if you happen to know what that means, it's not symmetric. Okay. So now let's just check. So this is simpler than what we did before. There's no constraints. Okay. Let's just check the equations of motion. Phi dot at a point x is the Poisson bracket of phi of x with h And I'm going to do this calculation for you so you see what these things are like. Okay. So this is the Poisson bracket of phi at x, with now h is an integral over space, but I've already called this point x, so I'm going to do an integral d3z. I have a half pi squared at point z plus derivative of phi at the point z squared. And I'm taking that Poisson bracket. Phi has zero Poisson bracket with the phi. That's part of that. I didn't write that. That's trivial. Poisson bracket of phi of x with phi of z at any other point z is zero. So this term is irrelevant. The Poisson bracket also satisfies A with BC is B Poisson bracket A with C plus A Poisson bracket B with C. And consequently, this is equal to, I'll pull outside the integral d3z, and then there's a 1/2 over here, and now there's a Poisson bracket of phi at x with pi of z, with pi of z on this side, plus the same term, phi of x, pi of z, sorry, with the pi of z on that side. Okay? I'm using this basic relation that Poisson brackets and commutators satisfy, which if you don't know, you can easily check. So, I think I have. The answer I'm going to get is very simple, but it's nice to go through the process because we'll have to go through some more complicated processes like this. So finally, I'm computing phi dot at the point x, and I'll just do one term. I have a term like the integral d3z of phi of x with pi of z, but phi of x with pi of z is delta 3, so I'm going to put that in right away. Delta 3 of x and z times pi of z, and actually they're just two terms like that. So the 1/2 cancels, and the integral, I can do the integral over the delta function, and that gives me pi of x. Any questions about that? Yes?
Right at the beginning, you're just always free to quote the integral?
Yes. You can quote because an integral is a sum, it's a limit of sums, and sums you can quote out of Poisson brackets. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. Okay. Now, let's do the other one. I want to do the other one because there's one lesson to be learned from that. So if I do pi of x dot, I start off the same way, pi of x with h. And here the terms of h that are important are the term in phi, because pi commutes with pi. So, for the same reason, I just have now the second term, integral d3x, and d3x, and I have pi of x with del a of phi, Poisson bracket, And let me be precise, this is d by d z of phi at z. Okay, and if that's squared, but I use the same thing, I can pull it outside the Poisson bracket. Sorry, okay, you see what I did? And there are actually, I didn't have to be, I was careful here about putting them to each side, but these, you have to be careful about where you put them in quantum mechanics, where these are operators, these are just functions. And they're just the same, so I don't have to be careful about where I put them, so it's just two of them. Okay, now watch what I do. Okay. It says the Poisson bracket of pi with the derivative of z of pi of z. So this is some function of x and z. But the derivative acts only here. So I can pull the derivative outside. That is the Poisson bracket of pi at x with d by dz, a at phi of z, is the same thing. And this is something that I would invite you to check, is that you can pull the Poisson bracket outside the derivative. Okay? So if I do that, then pi dot is the integral d3x d by dz a, the Poisson bracket. And now that I have the derivative outside the Poisson bracket, I'm going to use what I know the Poisson bracket is. The Poisson bracket is minus delta 3 I have my z and x messed up. This is pi dot of x. This is z. It's delta 3 of x and z. Okay. With the derivative acting on the delta function, like that, times del phi del z a. Okay? Now, a derivative a delta function is already a perilous business, and a derivative acting on a delta function is confusing. And at this point, you can make lots of mistakes. And the only right thing to do is to integrate by parts right away so you get the derivatives off the delta function. Okay. Never try to use some fact about the derivative of the delta function you may find in a book. Okay. Just integrate by parts and get rid of it. So if we integrate by parts, then I get an integral, and now you have to use a boundary condition that, for example, the derivative of phi at the boundary has to be zero, so I didn't say that, but you have to have a boundary condition, the derivative of phi at the boundary is zero. You integrate by parts, and then it's integral d3z, delta 3xz, and now it's just the Laplacian on phi at z. And now you can do the integral over the delta function, and you find that pi dot is del squared phi. Okay? So I'm sorry if that was slow. I don't know if it was for you, but that was, for me, very, very deliberate. But it's important to get all those steps right. Because, I mean, this is sort of like ballet or something, or, you know, tango. We're starting with the simple steps. And then there's definitely going to be more complicated steps. Okay. Let me just notice, I forget if this is Yeah, these are black ones. Oops. Just to put the whole thing together, pi phi, sorry, double dot at x, since phi dot is pi, then phi double dot is pi dot, which is del squared phi. So that implies that the del inversion on phi equals 0. So we have recovered the equation of motion from the Hamiltonian here. I could stop. I think we'll continue this next time, this session for you guys. I could stop, or I could go ahead and do what we just did for electromagnetism. Are you up for another 10 or 15 minutes, or is that too much? I would propose to stop, because it may be more than 10 or 15 minutes. Okay, so let's take this up next time. And I propose to keep going for a few times. Probably need one or two more times to catch you guys up. Okay, questions? Okay, is this the right level? Yes, no?
Well, I mean, for me, I've done some course before.
Okay.
It's good to recap.
Okay, good.
I personally haven't seen Yang Niels do this before at all, so it would be
good. Okay, so you have seen some version of this?
I've seen this for electromagnetism, but not for this sort of
thing. Okay, so you guys have seen it also for electromagnetism. Good.
Not in the Hamiltonian.
Okay. We are going to have to do it in the Hamiltonian form. So let me next time do electromagnetism in the Hamiltonian form, Yang-Mills theory, and then something that you probably have not done before, which is transcendence theory. Is that right? I assume you have not done transcendence theory. Okay. So let me leave you with a little puzzle. Then, okay? If you haven't done transcendence theory, which is, let's imagine that we have a three-manifold. So I'll call it sigma. And let it be compact. So it's a torus or a three-sphere and so forth, or something like that. Okay? And the topology will matter in just a minute. Okay? So I would like to write some dynamics in here, okay, without a metric. Now, when I wrote the dynamics for this, I used a metric. When I wrote the dynamics for Maxwell, I used a metric. Is there anything that I can write? Now, you need to know one fact, which is that without a metric, the integrals in d dimensions, the integrals that make sense are integrals of omega, which are d forms. And basically, that's because an object of the form of dx1 with dx2, let me just do a three-dimensional case, is meaningful in any coordinate system. It has an invariant meaning in any coordinate system. And not only that, not surprisingly, if I'm in three dimensions, all three forms are proportional to each other, because there's only one way to take these. In other words, if I take an object dxa wedge dxb wedge, let me use ij and k, because I've been using those for two-dimensional indices, dxk times omega ijk, there's actually only one degree of freedom, because these all three indices have to be unequal in order to get a non-zero object. So this is equal to omega 1, 2, 3 times dx1. Now I'm in any coordinate system, dx2 wedge dx3. Okay. So there's only one free form up to a function. And it happens if you check that under a change of coordinates, x goes to x prime, this goes to, oh, so let me say it precisely, the integral of omega, which is the integral of omega ABC dxA with dxB with dxC, is coordinate invariant. So integrals of three forms are well defined. And this is something you should, let me suggest this as something you could just check explicitly, that the integral is coordinate of the three form is coordinate invariant. Okay. So I want to write a theory of a three form without a metric. And I'm just going to give you the electromagnetic field, which is defined up there. Is there anything that I can write? Well, so I have A, I have dA, which is F. That's a two form. B squared on A is zero. So is there anything else I can write? How can I get a three form? DF is zero, remember, because it's D squared of A. Yes. So the only thing that I can write, the only three form I possibly can write, is A wedge F, which is the same thing as A wedge D A. Okay. Now, notice something. That's not gauge invariant. Right? Under a gauge transformation, this goes to A plus DF wedge DA. We know that DA is gauge invariant. So it goes to what we had before, A wedge DA, plus another term, which is DF wedge DA. So it's not gauge invariant. But at least it's something, this object is D of F wedge DA. So I guess I haven't showed you that, but FD of forms A wedge B is D of A wedge B plus A wedge D B, and there's a minus 1 to, if this is a P form and this is a Q form, there's a minus 1 to the P there. So this is something to check. So Q plus 1. So this is D of F wedge DA. Why is it that? Because again, D squared A is zero. So when I come here, I get this, and when I go to DA, that's zero. So this is not gauge invariant, this three form. But notice something, the integral of omega is gauge invariant, because that's the integral of A wedge dA. And under the same gauge transformation, that goes to the integral of A wedge dA plus the integral of D of F wedge dA. And the integral of the derivative is zero. So that's another property to check. The integral of D of any two form which is a three form, is zero. So omega, the integral of omega is well defined. So let's take that action. It's called the Chern-Simons action, or Chern and Simons, who first studied it. It's gauge invariant. And it's well defined on a manifold with no metric anywhere. So it's a kind of different variant of electromagnetism. So what are the field equations? Delta S is the integral of delta A with dA plus A with d delta A. Just taking the variation in each of the terms. But I can integrate by parts, and I get a sign that cancels the sign that you usually get, and you get 2 delta A. Remember, I'm doing this on a compact manifold, so there's no boundary, with dA. So the equations of motion are just dA equals 0, and that implies that F, which is dA, is equal to 0. So it looks very trivial, but it's not trivial for the following reason. Suppose, which I thought, I just want a little bit of space. Supposing that sigma is a torus. So I now take sigma to be a torus, and let me consider the following functions of the fields. And I mentioned this in the earlier lecture, so now I'm just filling in the details. And let me take one closed curve, which I call alpha, that goes from the floor to the ceiling. Another one I'll call beta, goes from the side wall to the other side wall, and another one, gamma, goes from the back wall to the front wall. And let me consider integral on alpha of A, and I'm going to call that A of alpha. And similarly for beta and for gamma, but let's just study that one, alpha. So what I mean, this is a closed curve. This is gauge invariant. So under gauge transformations, delta, well, A of alpha goes to the integral over alpha of A plus dF, which doesn't go to, is equal to the integral of alpha on A plus the integral on B of F, but the integral of a derivative is 0. This part is 0. So this is a way of saying that the line integral is gauge invariant around the closed curve. Let me maybe flesh that out. If I have a curve and it has a parameter s running along it, then what I really mean by this, by the integral on a curve of a one form, what I really mean is take A at some point alpha of s, compute the tangent vector, so there's some function gamma A of S, which is the embedding of the curve in the space. It has a tangent, alpha dot A of S, which is a tangent vector. That's a vector field on the circle, on a curve. I can contract that with the one form, S, and I can integrate that ds. And that's what I really mean. So this is the thing fleshed out. And then why is it that the integral of the derivative of a function is zero? This is the integral of d by d xa of the function at the point alpha of s. The tangent is d alpha ds at the point s ds. But this, by the chain rule, is just the integral ds of the derivative by s of the function evaluated at the point alpha of s by the chain rule. And that's an integral of a derivative, so that's zero. That is, it gives you the values between the two limits, but the two limits are just one point. So that's zero. So these objects are gauge invariant. Now, not only that, they can be anything. The fact that the curl of A in the region is zero doesn't prevent the line integral around a non-trivial curve from being anything you like. So the theory has degrees of freedom, which are related to these integrals. So it's far from trivial. So the theory has real degrees of freedom, and these are them. Okay, questions? Okay, so it's actually highly non-trivial and interesting. So this is a theory with lots of gauge symmetry and degrees of freedom, and it's a very interesting exercise to quantize this theory. And it's actually reasonably non-trivial mathematically. So it's something that we will do. Okay. Is there any way to do this without getting covered in trouble?
Don't worry about it.
Why would I want to not put a flash? I can see the point.
I think the whiteboards you get to do that.
Oh, from what
yeah.
Yeah, I hate whiteboards. Sorry if I did things that you should be sore, but
it's good.
It's okay.
It's good.
Right. You do it.
I wish you'd have to fill it in, but it's going to be
Sunday. I was talking about that man. It was like an Australian thing.